يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Well, hello everybody and welcome to Middle East Analysis, December. It's definitely that time of year where we look to Christmas, certainly from our perspective. But this Middle East Analysis is going to be split into two, if you will. We're going to look across the region, Middle East, North Africa, and maybe even a little bit lower than North Africa, but I'll come on to that. For the first half of this podcast, with Dr. Harry Hagopian, who thankfully is with us again this month, we'll look at the politics, we'll look at the terrain, we'll discuss that. But then we will segue halfway through into the Holy Land. We'll look at Palestine, of course, before that, but we will look into the Holy Land. And of course, we are coming up to Christmas. So I'm glad to say as well, not only Dr. Harry Hagopian in the studio, but we have Bishop Jim Curry, who for the Bishops' Conference is the lead bishop for the Holy Land. So you couldn't have a more appropriate guest for the second half of the show. Let's say hello to Harry Hagopian first of all. How are you?
Hello, James. I'm fine, thank you. And it's a good way of dividing it into two halves. It doesn't mean that Bishop Jim will not have any contributions in the first half or vice versa, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, I think it'll work
well.
It'll
be fun because it's the Advent season. And the Advent season is a season of hope. And hope also introduces an element of joy and expectation for the future. And the future, of course, is the celebration of the mystery of the Incarnation and what happened to Bethlehem and to the Feast of the Nativity. Perhaps the calendar date is something to quibble about, but let's not go there. And then we are where we are now in terms of three monotheistic faiths inhabiting a whole MENA and Gulf region.
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk incarnational, I should speak to our Catholic bishop, especially if we're going to talk if we're going to talk hope as well, Bishop Jim. You're very welcome. How are you?
Well, I'm always glad to be here. Always good to be with Harry, Dr. Hagopian, and yourself. I always find I learn more than I contribute, which is not a bad way to approach life.
I've been doing that,
a lifelong learner.
I've been doing that for two decades with this man. Don't worry about that. We're all in that boat.
Yeah, and we're all searching for hope. It's tough at the moment, isn't it, to find signs of hope, but they are there in the way we live, in the way we act, in the choices we make. So I hope the two halves won't be one bad half and a second better half.
I don't think they will collide. But you said something quite interesting there. There aren't that many signs of hope. I agree with that. But for me, hope is a more epistemological substance rather than just a palpable substance, in the sense that I look around me, I see everything in black. That doesn't mean I lose my hope, because hope springs eternal.
Oh, you're sounding a little bit like Padre Pio, I might say. look at you. Formally integrated into the Catholic world, Dr.
Hagopian. Agreed when we were going to do, it's neither formal nor informal integration. It's just a human reality. And the fact is that this Middle East analysis this month in December is going to be a special festive Christmassy one, which is why you've divided into two halves, because you cannot divest the region of its politics, but you also have to talk about what makes the people of the region a bit more excited, an excitement they need, just as they need hope.
Of course they do. And our listeners as well. You see, I've got a hopometer here. Here's my hopometer. I'm thinking for the first half, it might be somewhere down here as we talk the politics. For those, you know, if you can't see me, you'll just have to imagine I'm raising the hopometer here. So for the second half, we'll look at the real reason for the season, as they say. People do tend to weaponize Christmas, sadly, at this time of year. But we're not doing that. We're going to look at what it is on that day, and in fact, every other day for us. But first of all, let's start with Lebanon, Harry. When we talk about Lebanon, obviously, from my perspective, I think of Pope Leo XIV's recent visit. What do you think about
it? It was a very successful visit, more successful than I thought it would be. And I think he did a brilliant job both in Turkey when he went to Istanbul and Ankara. In Ankara, he met with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and then with other officials. Then he went to Istanbul, where he met with His Holiness Bartholomew of the Eastern Orthodox Church. He also visited the Armenian Orthodox Church, which was a very, very nice little event, because right at the entrance to the church, he broke bread, and there is the bread and salt welcome that Armenians do, but not only Armenians. And then he went to İznik, because the whole purpose of his visit to Turkey was to celebrate the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. And İznik used to be called Nicaea before. And in a sense, it was very successful, because I was impressed that given this was his first apostolic journey, I was impressed by the fact that he managed it quite well, because he does not have the same charisma and charm that his predecessor, Pope Francis, had. He doesn't have the touchy-feely attitude that his predecessor had. And I was wondering if he's going to come out of his shell. And he did. And in fact, I have developed a way of reading Pope Leo XIV. It's not so much by what he says as it is by his facial features. Mm. They say a lot about what he's thinking of. When he's annoyed, there were a couple of such instances. When he was very moved and happy, there were a couple of such instances as well, not least having moved from Turkey into Lebanon, where he was met by the leaders of all the Christian communities, or sects as they are called sometimes, as well as the Muslim leadership there, particularly the Sunni, but also the Shia and Druze. And in a way, one of the highlights of that visit to Lebanon in a spiritual sense was when they went to Annaya. Annaya is where Mar Sharbel, Saint Sharbel, who is the founder of the Maronite Catholic Church, is buried. And I thought it was a very moving visit, pilgrimage, as it were, there. And then for me, the most moving was not that and any other meeting he had with all sorts of people, because inevitably we cannot forget that any pope is not only the leader of the Catholic Church, not only the Bishop of Rome, but also the head of a state. And therefore, he did all these things. But what really stood out for me, and what really stood out to many, many, many Lebanese friends and associates that I know, was when he went and prayed at the site where there was the port explosion, and which still remains unresolved and unsolved. And I could see how moved he was. And what moved me personally was not so much the fact that he went there, but the fact that he went and met the families of the victims who had died in that terrible, horrible explosion, and the way ordinary Lebanese, young and old, came to him and hugged him. Now, sometimes people have this idea that the Pope is an untouchable person because he's surrounded by an aura of sanctity, so you cannot touch him. And the Lebanese were so genuine with their affections that they just went around hugging him and basically crying over his shoulder because of the pain of what had happened at that port explosion. And I thought that was very, very interesting. I'll just mention one final thing, that his visit to Turkey, formerly known as Turkey, was basically because of the 1700th anniversary we've just alluded to, and it was his initiative. Going to Lebanon was something that Pope Francis wanted to do, so he's basically following in the footsteps of his predecessor.
Well, I'm going to bring you in here, Bishop Jim. I'm not going to ask you to compare and contrast popes, as Dr. Hagopian has done there, no, with regard to charisma. There's certainly a lot of gravitas with Leo, and I think what Harry said very well there was that those sort of actions, those gestures, they do have that power. Did you detect that through the TV screen? I know you weren't actually there. Tell me what you
No, I was fascinated to watch it all on TV and through the Vatican News Service, and I was very struck by the joy of the welcome that he received, the sense of relief amongst the people. There seemed to be a genuine appreciation that he was there amongst them as a sign of hope. You're right, he has a very prudent, thoughtful way about him, And his facial expressions, you're right, do give a clue as to how he's feeling. I mean, I was struck by his appeal to the world that peace is possible in the midst of the mess that he was encountering, that you find in Lebanon and so many countries, the conflicts, the struggle to regain some sense of equilibrium. And the invitation he gave to the world, well, through Lebanon, that Lebanon demonstrates a way in which different cultures, different religions, different people can live together and make us a society. And that was always Lebanon's proud boast, that they were Muslim and Christian, non-aligned, if you like, could live together and make something really rather wonderful, a wonderful mosaic. And he was calling people back to that reality or that vision or that hope. That struck me very much. And on his way back to the Vatican, in one of his statements, he invited the Western world, whatever that means, not to be afraid of Islam, but to go out and encounter and go out and to speak and to see the brother and the sister and the other person. I thought that was a really interesting call, echoing his predecessor, of course, Francis, the call to encounter with another person.
A couple of points there, Bishop, if I may. The first one about Islam and the conviviality between Islam and Christianity in the MENA region. I thought that was very telling when he went to the Blue Mosque in Istanbul in Turkey. And yes, he was trying to make it a point that we shouldn't be cautious, I would say, or we shouldn't allow our prejudices to stop us from reaching out to the other. But one point I'd like to make also, because off mic we were talking about hope. For me, what mattered most of all as far as Pope's visit to Lebanon was concerned, because I was following it far more closely when he went to Lebanon than when he was in Turkey, is that the people, as Bishop Jim said, were elated, there was a mass sense of joy, a wave of joy and a wave of hope. And that, to me, was both a pleasant experience, but it was also a sad one. It was a sad one because it shows you how depressed the Lebanese people are due to their political realities. You've got the issue, the lingering issue of the disarmament of Hezbollah by the Lebanese army. You've got the pressure that is being put upon Lebanon and its government, its president, its cabinet, its prime minister by Israel on the one hand, America on the other hand, that Iran and the expectations Iran has of what Hezbollah should and could still do in Lebanon. The people were basically finding this visit as nothing short of a catharsis, a spiritual and existential catharsis, whereby they said, a man of hope coming with a message of hope, telling us, let us overcome our gloom and doom, and let us hope for the better. Now, the Lebanese are extremely canny people, and every one of them knew that the Pope is not going to change anything in Lebanon except introduce a moment of hope. But that moment is of hope is something on which they rode, and they are still riding, because I can still see it in social media. I can still see it in people's words by saying, oh, yes, you know, the Pope came and he did this and he did that. And I tell you, the Lebanese deserve hope just as anybody else in the region.
Now, I'm going to ask you one quick question here, because in the aftermath of the visit, I did read a piece that was suggesting that what I've often seen, complicated as it is a bit of a template for the constitution, you know, multi-confessionalism, if you like, that stake that everyone has in the conversation. And I read a piece that said both Christians and Muslims were sort of, well, it needs shaking up, it needs to change. What do you think they meant by that? Does it need to change?
Oh, that's nothing new, James. That's been going on for years and years and years, whereby they're talking not only of shifting or changing, amending the constitution, but also of going and doing a Taif Agreement 2, Mark 2, which basically, because if you look at the demographics of Lebanon, the Christians in Lebanon now are 30% of the country. And it's probably the largest Christian presence across the region, given the number of the population. So the Shia are getting higher in their numbers. The Sunnis are pretty much where they have been. So a lot of people are saying that the realities, the demographic realities, which inevitably reflect on the political realities, are changing. And therefore, in order to be able to get out of this impasse, this cul-de-sac, the best way to do it is to revise or amend or have a Taif Agreement Mark II. But the Lebanese are also very careful because they're also very wily and canny politicians, and they know that if you tinker too much with the structures that are holding 18 communities together, as the bishop said, it's the only country in the Arab world which has this system, it could actually improve or it could go south and collapse, and that would bring even more despair to the people. So
what would you do?
I would think about it, and I would probably do some amendments, but I would do it carefully. The problem with Lebanon is not only what the Lebanese would wish to do or what they could do. The problem with Lebanon is everybody from outside Lebanon, from the Americans to the Iranians to the Europeans to the French, everybody thinks they have a stake and everybody thinks they have a word to say about what Lebanon should do or shouldn't do. So much so that it has become a bit of a reality, sad reality though, that any decision taken by the president or the prime minister of Lebanon is subject to what Saudi Arabia, Iran, France, the United States would wish to see it happen. And this is part of the problem. What is your definition of sovereignty? And how do you impose sovereignty when you are in your own self too weak to be able to stand up against all those others who have their own interests? Because at the end of the day, yes, it's all Arab brothers coming together. It's all a lot of culture that sort of espouses with each other. But having said that, each country has its own interests. And that is what Lebanon, amongst others, we'll come to Syria now, the same thing in a sense, although it's an entirely different ballgame. I'll stop on this. Every single pope who's gone to Lebanon, JP II, Francis, Benedict, Leo, they've had a spectacular reception. That's partly because the Lebanese are a people of hospitality. They're a people who have in their hearts joy. That joy has been muted because of the realities on the ground. But what will it do? I always say, let's be hopeful, but let's also not lose touch with reality.
Yeah, very well said. Bishop Jim, I am going to ask you one final question before we do move on to Syria, as Harry said. Now, when you have a papal succession, as we did in 2025, it's completely normal to have documents which are potentially written by four hands, as they say, or possibly two, yes, might be a better way of putting it. You know, you have a transition, quite literally, and the incumbent completes the work of the predecessor to a certain extent. Yes. Did you feel that this first overseas papal visit was something of Pope Leo stepping out on his own as his own man?
I think we saw him emerging as his own man, and we, as Harry has said, were starting to understand his own nuances and his own stresses. I mean, Pope Francis had planned to go to Nicaea to mark the 1700th anniversary of the Creed, you know, which celebrates the Incarnation and so much more and binds so many Christians together. So he was following, as you know, in the church, very few things change. There is always development. And development is always consistent with what's gone before. So the Holy Father, I think, was developing the inheritance of Pope Francis and deepening, if you like, its expression in the church. That seems to be my experience of him. He's leading us to a deepening and a development of what Francis was so, in a sense, spectacular in his presentation. This Pope is more reflective, and I suspect he may deepen what Francis started off in the church and embed it.
And he may also heal some of the wounds left behind by Pope Francis, because Francis was very outspoken. He upset a lot of people within the Vatican structures itself. I think one of the things he's trying to do also is to heal those wounds and bring the church back together.
No doubt. I think more people will walk with this Pope, Pope Leo. Some were a little rattled by Pope Francis, and I think Pope Leo is one who will walk with people, and people will feel confident to walk with him.
Well, I think when we say pontifex, we do literally look at the bridge builder,
yes,
don't we?
Yes.
And he does seem to be a bridge builder. And perhaps this is a difference in religious style, community-wise, between Jesuits and Augustinians, perhaps.
It's also a question of character, James. I would invite friends and listeners to this podcast to just have a look, if they want, if they're interested in the topic at all, to look at the way the late Pope Francis moved the people and the way Pope Leo moved the people. With Pope Francis, it was much more wearing your heart on your sleeve. With Pope Leo, it was much more, let me think about it. Let me say something thoughtful. And there are people in the Catholic Church, and I know some people, and I've discussed
this
with the bishop as well, who are saying that the church is not a political institution. The church should be courageous enough, brave enough to wear its mission, its prophetic ministry, and say human dignity and human value are what matter most of all, rather than think a little bit. But the reality is today that you have to think a little bit. So perhaps a more thoughtful Pope at the moment, as I liked what the bishop said now, that each successor develops the teaching of the predecessor. And perhaps that development could go a little bit in this direction or a little bit in that direction. And if the Holy Spirit has anything to do with it, then it will be successful.
Yes, and to your point, and not being too facile, Jesuits are known for pushing the boundaries. That's part of their charism. And Augustinians, if I've understood them correctly, is charity in love in community. So the community, you must love the brothers and the sisters and bring them with you, always with love. So perhaps we're just seeing different emphases.
So what do you say about me, Bishop, who has studied and been brought up in a French Jesuit school?
Yeah, but you have a strong Dominican influence as well, Harry. So you're always searching for the truth. And always remember, was it the late Cardinal Hume said, every exploration of truth is an exploration of the mind of God. So you have a wonderful synthesis of the Jesuit pushing the boundaries, but always seeking the truth in your Dominican
instincts. That. You made my day. Thank you, Bishop.
Well, I've got to be honest, this is fast turning into a love-in. Desist immediately. Let's look at Syria now, Harry. And the obvious point for me, and possibly for you, of course, is that it's a year since the fall of al-Assad. And I remember in a Middle East analysis, not the one we've just had, the one before probably, or the one even before that, where you said that the interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, should be given time. Has he been given enough time? 12 months later, where are we at? Are you hopeful for Syria?
12 months is not a long time, considering that for 14 years the Assad regime were basically destroying Syria in more ways than most people realize, certainly in the West, where we sometimes live in our own bubbles. But what I would say is that, yes, it was the first anniversary and there was a lot of ink that was spilled in here and there about this. What I would say is this. Here is somebody who was an Islamist, who was up north in Idlib in Syria. Suddenly, for whatever reason, and I'm not going to go into this because that will take another half hour of your podcast, he found himself as the president, interim president, I should add, of Syria. Fair enough. Having become president, he was faced with two things. Syria was an international pariah, and he was not too far from that either, because he had just come from what was known in our Western circles as the Islamist jihadist militiaman in Idlib. Although that also is questionable at this stage. But at the same time, when you look at the man, he also looked at Assyria domestically, where 80% of the population are below the what do you call that?
Poverty line.
The poverty line. Institutions had been decimated. The situation was very, very bad. And as we all know, there were clashes in the south with the Druze, a little bit in the northeast with the Kurds, along the coast with the Alawites. So he ended up having an internal problem to exercise his authority and bring the country together after so many years of horrendous crimes being committed. There was a program a few days ago by France 24 on their focus program talking about the number of children that were kidnapped from the bosom of their families during the Assad dynasty time and taken and put in orphanages, and then God knows what happened to them. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. So he had that, and he also had to be able to work with the international community, if for nothing else, to remove and relieve the sanctions that were imposed during Assad's thing, whether the Caesar sanctions in America, whether the EU sanctions or whatever, because the country was an international fiscal pariah as much as it was a political pariah. Now, December 2025, 1 year hence, what has happened? He has done remarkably well on the international front. Suddenly, President Trump, never a barometer for me of wisdom, has actually embraced him. Now, I say he's not a barometer of wisdom, but he is a very, very versatile tactician and even strategist. He knows how to play the political game because he looks at it from a transactional viewpoint. He has embraced him. Suddenly, because he's embraced him, on the advice of the Saudi crown prince, the Europeans also suddenly woke up to the fact, no, we need this man. Now, why we need this man, how we need this man, how we found ourselves dealing with this man is not the issue now. But on the international scene, he's done very well. He has readmitted Syria into the international forum. Locally, domestically, internally, Syria is still bleeding. Syria is still suffering. Syria is still in pain. And if he does not manage to find a way, because it's very good to have international contacts because you get money, you build up institutions, you manage to do some commerce and trade. But if he does not manage to amend the internal domestic polarities that are colliding within Syria itself, he's going to have a very hard time, considering that some people are saying that he might not be with us in a year's time either. So I'm very cautious about what happens with Syria at the moment, because the whole region is in ebullition, and Syria is certainly also in ebullition, and it is a strategic country in the heartland of the Levant. And so what happens next will be very telling, and at the moment I don't know which way it's going to go, but I can see hope. We keep talking about hope today. We can see hope if we look abroad. We see far, far less hope at the moment if we look internally.
Well, I was going to ask you about refugees and whether they would feel comfortable returning in any sort of numbers to Syria, but you've almost answered that, haven't you?
Yes, I've answered that. And the refugees, the poor refugees, are caught between a rock and a hard place. The majority of them are in Turkey and Lebanon. There are a few others in Egypt, Jordan, here and there, but they are where they are. And the host countries don't want them anymore. And their country of origin is not yet up to much scratch internally. But refugees also develop their own way of protecting themselves, and a lot of them are drifting back. There is more openness.
To be part of the solution.
Yes, to be part of the solution. And Syria is more open now. Journalists can go in. People can fly in and out. But Ahmed al-Sharaa, the temporary interim president, surrounded by his close friends, particularly the foreign minister, is keeping a very tight control. And I can understand that because he's afraid that if he doesn't have that control, it'll slip away and he'll be gone tomorrow. So while the other one is in Moscow. So in a sense, I'm hopeful that something good might come out of it, but I cannot predict yet. You and I have done Middle East analysis many times, and we've had many predictions, and some of them have come true, others haven't. It's the nature of the game.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Well, we were, as I say, going to divide this podcast in two, so we need to move more swiftly, potentially, because we have more realities to cover. Let's talk Iraq, Harry. Now, obviously, we've had elections since our last Middle East analysis. Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, if I've pronounced that right, yeah, I can always see him smiling at me.
I love it when you struggle with Arabic names and you insist on struggling with Arabic names.
I'm trying. I am trying. It's when I see the sort of either the eyebrow shoots up or there's a little cheeky smile. So I know maybe I was close, but no cigar, perhaps. But anyway.
Close and a cigar.
Close and a cigar. Will he remain Prime Minister? Will he be able to form a government? They're the questions I have. Where do you want to go?
Let's rush. I'm not going to go very far with it. The elections took place, the legislative elections, in other words, the parliamentary elections in Iraq, took place on the 11th of November. Now, the key issue is who's going to form the next government and who's going to be the Prime Minister. Pre-elections, it was Sudani. Post-elections, there are other factors playing into it. There are other people. There is Maliki, who used to be a former prime minister, who's very strongly trying to take hold, to grab the levers of power. Then there is Muqtada Sadr. All these are Shia, by the way, communities. Muqtada Sadr, who refused, him and his community refused to participate in the elections, but he has a very strong impact or influence as to who becomes the prime minister in Iraq. And if people look at my social media and at X, they will see that I posted an announcement of a very interesting seminar that is taking place now as we're recording, but it'll be available on YouTube for people who have the channel, by the Arab Center in Doha in Qatar, that they are basically going to discuss those elections. So all I would say at the moment, Iraq gurgles in oil, but also gurgles with corruption. And the Iranian Shia influence is very strong. And the counter-Iranian American influence is very strong as well. And never the twain shall meet. So who's going to be prime minister? We'll find out when he becomes prime minister.
That's a good way of putting it. And let's be honest, it's the same sort of uncertainty as Syria, isn't it? It really is a wait and see.
It is. 329 seats in the parliament and nobody has a majority. So they're basically fighting over who wants to be. Everybody wants to be prime minister because at the end of the day, you're sitting on a big barrel of oil and that brings in a lot of money. But there are also other interferences. Again, we talk like Syria, like Lebanon. What do the outside powers want to see happen? What do the Arab world want? The Gulf countries want? What does Iran want? What do the Americans, who have a presence there? At the end of the day, the Americans basically messed up Iraq completely during the first and second Gulf Wars. So what are we going to do? And the Europeans, we are the banker, not always the decision maker.
Oh, hold on. We might get a 20-point plan for Europe the way we're going. Anyway, let's not go into that. You did actually, Harry, want to just mention Sudan. I know in 2009, when we started Middle East analysis, we possibly could have called it MENA analysis because we've always covered North Africa from the Arab Spring. We've done that many times. But you want to go a little bit south of North Africa, as we did last month, and just to discuss where we're at with Sudan.
I will do three things in one so that you can then say we finished with the first part. Sudan. Last time we dealt with Sudan quite a bit. Sudan is basically being destroyed with millions of refugees across the country, certainly in El Fasher and other places in Darfur, as a result of the ego of two generals. And each general is supported by a number of outside countries. So the standoff still continues. The killing still continues. The pretensions for peace and Arab countries and non-Arab countries saying, oh yes, we want peace, we're going to do this, while weapons are still coming into the country and arming both sides. So in a sense, Sudan is also in a very, very bad place at the moment. So really, it's a watch and see. And if anybody is interested to know more about what's happening and the immense humanitarian relief that the United Nations and the OCHA and SERF, CRF, are providing for Sudan, all we need to do, all you need to do is just Google the name Tom Fletcher, who is the human, who's the relief chief of the UN for humanitarian work in that whole region from Gaza to Sudan and onward. And you can hear his complaint because people are not providing the money for the UN to do its job. But at the same time, enormous amount of work is being done. And Tom Fletcher, unlike other politicians, says what he thinks far more clearly. So you can follow that as well. The second thing I would say, and that is something that I think our listeners, my listeners, your listeners maybe, would have to take on board as well, that what is happening now are two things. One, in the region itself, in the MENA region, there is the creation of zones of influence. Turkey is one of those people acting, trying to carve out its zone of influence. Syria is an example, very, very much in Syria, Turkey. Iran is trying to carve out and maintain its zones of influence. Its desperate attempts to keep Hezbollah going is an example of that. Israel is trying to be the bully of the whole region, and it wants to be the referee who decides what happens in the region, be that in Iraq, be that in Syria, be that in Lebanon, be that in Palestine. By Palestine, I don't only mean the total razing of Gaza, but I also mean the crimes that are being committed in the West Bank day in, day out, by settlers, supposedly, illegal though they are under international law. But the settlers are a problem. But who's supporting the settlers? The government. So it goes all the way up to the prime minister's office. So we're looking at zones of influence in the region, which are superimposed by a zone of influence by the two global superpowers, if I can still call them that, America and Russia. And in my opinion, the Russian Federation and the United States are trying to carve out the world into two halves and take us back to another version of what was the Cold War before. And unless we in Europe, who are being accused of being a decaying continent, who basically are being told that London and Paris are basically dead, that our mayor in London is a horrible man who's doing a horrible job. If we are going to preserve some rule of law and some modicum of sanity, politically speaking, we should wake up and smell the coffee. That is in terms of the zones of influence. Otherwise, if we don't, and that means the church should speak, that means NGOs should speak, that means politicians should speak, because we are no longer in a world where we can have the luxury of sitting back, having our G&T and pontificating about the world. The world is sliding into a darker place unless we do something to at least delay or halt that slide. And on an optimistic note, or dare I say, a hopeful note, I might remind our listeners that as we speak, the FIFA Arab Cup is taking place in Doha in Qatar, and it is absolutely fabulous. And I watched the one that took place at the Lusail Stadium in Doha between the Atlas Lions, which are the Moroccans, and the Green Falcons, who are the Saudis. And it was a fantastic match. The Saudis, I thought, were playing very well, but they had a lot of misses, and there have been others as well. So I invite people to realize one thing. When we talk football, we think, oh, it's European. No, it's not European. It's also Middle Eastern, and the Arab world is very famous on football. And guess what? The Palestinians qualified on the top of their group as well.
Oh, there you go. Now, look, as an international lawyer, I have to ask you, are you resting your case for the first half of this podcast?
Yes, I am, and I'll bang the gavel.
Very good. Well, talking about sounds, we're going to hear a track now, Harry, because I was talking to you about Reem Bana. Now, you can explain to me, because I can see you're smiling, so I've probably mispronounced that as well. lovely. You can explain this track to me, because you sent me a link. I had a listen, very moved by it. Now, she's a Palestinian musician from Nazareth, isn't she?
She's a wonderful... She's the late Reem Bana, not Bana.
Bana.
Bana. She comes from a well-known family. She's from Nazareth, from the Galilee. She's a wonderful Palestinian who has recorded also this song, which is very Christmassy for Christmas, which is O Virgin Mary, Maryam al-Batul in Arabic, or Maryam al-Batul Fouqi. And I thought it's beautiful, since we're doing a sort of Christmassy festive MEA podcast, hasn't yet
we're
appeared so,
we're
but we're
there.
Getting there. I thought it would be very nice to move from the first half to the second half and segue via this piece. And you kindly were talking to me about this. And I said, brilliant, go ahead with it, do it. Because this piece has been recorded and sung by many people. Another person who's done it is a wonderful, wonderful Lebanese singer, Tania Qassis. But this one, I wanted to give precedence to this version, because Reem Bana is also the example of Palestinian resilience, what is known in Arabic as sumud. And therefore, at a time when we're talking about the immeasurable difficulties and challenges facing all Palestinians, Christian and Muslim alike, by a world that is too uncaring, I thought this would be a very nice reminder to us of the hope that you were talking about.
Well, why don't we allow people to make a cup of tea, possibly even rest their ears from our speaking for a little while, and we'll listen
You're
to...
You're being ever so polite. You mean me rattling on continuously.
Look, without you, we wouldn't have a podcast, would we? I'm appreciative, don't worry. So let's listen appropriately to Reem Bana.
It's beautiful. And I also, if I can make a shout for Sarah Grira. Sarah Grira is the editor-in-chief of Orion 21 newspaper, which is based in France, because she also is a big fan of Reem Bana.
Let's have a listen.
Yeah. الشمس والقمر وكل نجم بأفلاك السماء سرى يا
Well, actually, Dr. Harry Hagopian. What an appropriate choice of music. I think that changes the mood. It's a gear shift nicely into the second part of this podcast, wouldn't you say?
Welcome to the second part, James. And let's hear more of the bishop and a little less of me.
Well, there's
a challenge.
it's that time, Bishop Jim.
Oh dear.
Now, I did challenge you before, didn't I, as to where we find hope at the moment. And at least the one thing that we can do, even over here, we're in London, but, you know, in the West, we do look eastwards, don't we? Unavoidably. But sometimes people, I think, I've asked you this before, Harry, but I'm going to ask Bishop Jim. People forget. They know about Christmas. They get used to the season. But I wonder if they really think about where this all happened and what it means to us as Catholics.
It's a good question, James. And I think we always have to bring people back to the reality that Christianity came from the East. Jesus was born a first century Palestinian Jew in Bethlehem. His family fled to Egypt. And there are many who see, you know, that the Egyptian influence, the mysticism has found its way into Christianity. Lots of scholars have been doing some extraordinary work there. So it's always important. And again, our eyes are brought back to Bethlehem. I was really, in one sense, pleased to see that the mayor of Bethlehem and the people of Bethlehem gathering again in Manger Square for the lighting for the first time in many years of the Christmas tree. And there were fireworks and there were speeches. But it was a bittersweet moment because the light was back on the Christmas tree. I always remember visiting Bethlehem a few years ago and a Muslim gentleman took a group of us and gave us a cup of tea. And he said, "I just want to thank you for Jesus." Oh, he said, "Why?" I said, "Because without Jesus, Bethlehem would be nothing." So we all roared laughing. But I took his point. And the mayor said, and all the other officials who were there gathered in Manger Square, "Please come back. Please come and see us. Please come back to this place where the incarnation took place, that the Word was made flesh." And I think it's an invitation that people want to take up, are anxious to take up, maybe a little nervous about taking up, but we're being asked, and the Latin Patriarch has issued that invitation again. Please come and see us. Come and see the living stones. I was listening again to a broadcast recently of a very large group of American pastors made a visit to the Holy Land, you know, from lots of independent churches. And what struck those who were living, the Christians who were living there in the Holy Land, is that they didn't go and visit them, the living stones. They went, if you like, to the dead stones of historic places, but they didn't make contact with the Christians who lived there and listen to their voices. And I think one of the things I've learned in recent years is to try and listen to the voices that are coming from the Christians who live the Christian life, the Christian experience in the Holy Land. And there are many voices coming through, both disturbing and challenging and with seeds of hope.
Harry, I can see you nodding there.
Yes, I'm nodding because I liked what the bishop has said. I was also very moved when I saw that Christmas tree, Bishop, just a little tweak, which makes it even more moving. That tree was there until 2 years ago. It's only been absent for 2 years since the Gaza war started.
Yes.
So they decided to put the Christmas tree, and you should have seen the throngs of Bethlehemite Palestinians assembled in Manger Square. That's the tree. And I also would say that there was also an ecumenical party of all the church leaders and the church representatives, not only the leaders. I'm sick and tired of talking about leaders. I'm also talking about ordinary pastors who run everyday churches. They all got together, they sang, they spoke in Bethlehem in front of Manger Square, which also was that sense of koinonia, that sense of fellowship coming together. That was great. But I would also add, and I'm glad that the bishop brought it up, the person who commented about those American evangelical pastors coming, just walking as if it's only stones and there are no Christians there, was the director of the Bethlehem Bible College in Palestine, who's based in Bethlehem. And he basically raised something which is very, very important, because what you said cannot just be overlooked or with one sentence. The West, either thinks, Trump thinks, that if we talk Christianity, we should look at the West. Probably he thinks we should look at the United States, but we should also look at Europe. They forget, as you said, as the bishop reminded us very strongly, that Christianity is in the region, which is why I don't even call it the Holy Land as only Israel-Palestine. The Holy Land is Israel, is Palestine, is Jordan, is Lebanon. When the Pope was in Lebanon, they asked him, why didn't you go to the south of Lebanon, where there are biblical references as well? It's also Egypt. It's also all these countries. So we have, first of all, to remember that those are the Christians. The second thing we have to also acknowledge is that in the West, we have lost that sense of spirituality that we have in the East. If I go to the East, the sense of the transcendent is so much more apparent than in the West, where for us, Christmas is only going and getting those boring songs in shops and supermarkets and eating and drinking and having fun. And one out of maybe 100 would think, but you know what? Where did it start? That is not there. But I'm going to bring it back a little bit, because what I'm saying is not me giving you a senior gripe. What I'm saying is that if we, at least, or those of us who acknowledge that Christianity and our Christian faith sprang from the MENA region, the Middle East, the Holy Lands with an S, then it behooves upon us to listen to what they're telling us and not listen but do what we want to do. In other words, we have to reflect their viewpoint as well, because they are the people who are witnessing to their faith on those biblical lands. And I think they have something to say. And just on a personal note, Bethlehem to me is very, very precious, because it's a very tiny place. Bethlehem, Beit Jala, Beit Sahur. Each one has a meaning. And when I was a kid, really a kid, before I went to France, we used to sit in Dad's car every Christmas day. We would go from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. We'd go into the Basilica of the Nativity. We'd go down there to have a little prayer. And then it was the same every year. And then after that, we would go, and I'd be all dressed up. And then after that, we'd go out there. There would be in the square many falafel stalls. We'd have a falafel sandwich. We'd meet a couple of friends there, talk to them, and then take the car and go back to Jerusalem. This was a ritual that my dad was very fond of, and I thought it was very nice. And when you go into the Church of the Nativity, the Basilica, it's a very naked place. It doesn't have ostentation. It doesn't have too much of the... I mean, they've done it up a bit, but still. And I think that helps, because it brings it down to exactly the faith you're talking about, rather than being taken up by all the iconography all over the place. So Bethlehem is important, but the living stones, the Christians of the Holy Lands, are very important, and perhaps we should listen to them. Not that their leaders listen to them, but at least we, if we advocate for their causes, we should listen to them and reflect their viewpoint as well, which is what the director of the Bethlehem Bible College was saying. You come here and you don't even acknowledge us as being Christians living in this country.
Yeah, very fair point. I mean, it makes me think, Bishop Jim, of almost 12 months ago when we were in Manger Square, again, off the back of a ceasefire, a fragile one, again. So, you know, history repeats itself, doesn't it? A few things will be different when we go again in January. One, I hope this doesn't sound too trivial, but one of those things was the sort of relatively iconic Pope Mobile that you used to see, not quite in Manger Square, but just sitting off before you walk up into Manger Square. Now, that's been...
That's a gift from Pope Francis.
It was a Pope Francis legacy piece, wasn't it? To turn that into a sort of mobile medical, not quite an ambulance, but...
No, it is an ambulance. It's being used as an ambulance.
Although if you look inside, there's not a lot of room in there.
No, there isn't a lot of room, but it's more symbolic than anything else.
Absolutely. So we won't see that. But wasn't it telling when we went? I mean, I really enjoyed hearing Harry's sort of very, you know, youthful recounting of a very simple, I think that's a good word, and beautiful pilgrim experience. For us, there's always a dimension, isn't there? There's a political dimension. But we do come as pilgrims. We do come on pilgrimage.
Yes, I would love to have a falafel sandwich now in Bethlehem. You've set a challenge there, Harry. Yeah, well, with the Holy Land Coordination Group, you know, the group of bishops that goes from across the world, coordinated by the English and Welsh bishops here, will visit again in January. And we make a point of visiting communities, the living stones. And on our last visit, you know, we tried to listen carefully. I hope in this next visit, I think we want to see where there are signs of hope.
Hmm.
We want to see who is speaking to each other, who is trying to facilitate a new beginnings in what is, by any stretch of the imagination, a complicated situation. So, you know, the 20 or 21 point peace plan, which now exists as a UN resolution, we'd like to understand where is the substance in that? Who is going to put some flesh on those words? I mean, I'm very conscious. I led a carol service recently. You know, you'd be surprised as a bishop in the Advent season. And I had to give a reflection. And I came back to this reflection of trying to listen to the words that we're hearing from the Christians who live in these holy lands. And some of the words are really disturbing and challenging. You may have heard of the Kairos 2 document, the Palestinian Christian Institute, a gathering of very impressive scholars, pastors on the ground. And the words they are using are words that sound ugly to our so-called Western ears. You know, they are talking, they use words like ethnic cleansing. There are accusations of genocide, of displacement, of occupation, of apartheid. Now, we find those words land very hard on our ears and we find them very difficult to hear. And yet they say to us, don't patronize us. We are telling you what our experience is. Will you please listen to it? And will you respond? You know, the Archbishop of York, he picked up some of these words and reflected them back. They were not easy listening for Christians here. But I give him credit for, I mean, he had an encounter with unauthorized settlers who gave him not a warm welcome, chased him off the land. I think he was very chastened by that experience. And he brought that experience back to us. At the same time, we have the voice of the Latin Patriarch, Cardinal Pizzaballo, who says, if we lose sight of each other's faces, we lose sight of the face of God. So we have to keep looking at each other, keep talking to each other. But the conversations are becoming, I mean, they're almost impossible. And the Christian population, one of the priests I was talking to recently who's living there, they've done a count again of the Christian population. I think in the West Bank, it's gone down from something like 46,000 to 37,000 to 38,000. 12,000 Christians have gone. And there is a real danger now. We've talked about it for years, but a real danger that the Holy Land could become a sort of a Disneyland, you know, denuded of a Christian community that still keeps faith. But the challenge of existing there because of the attack on their civil and economic rights is distressing. And we need to hear that. And we need to find ways of communicating that message of Christmas to our fellow Christians here in England and Wales and in the Western world.
And with that Kairos 2 document, just to sort of challenge a little bit, what do you as a Christian Catholic leader, what do you feel we should be doing with that document?
Well, certainly we have to read it. It's a highly critical document of people like me, of bishops, of church leaders. It challenges us to become stronger advocates for that voice in the public forum here. And I think what I'm doing now is that I'm acknowledging that the document exists, the reality of the pain it talks about, the challenge it puts before me. One thing I can do is say, here are voices, authentic voices from the Holy Land. We have to listen to these voices and we need a response which is more than platitudes. We need to say, how can we give hope to those voices?
Whilst recognising their frustrations, I guess,
yes,
on top of
yes.
all that. Harry, same question to you in a way.
I think what the bishop said is very powerful. If I might just interject first by saying that you're one of the avant-garde bishops in the Catholic Church, as far as I know. And we are friends, so I know a little bit where you stand on these things. So it's very encouraging to hear you say that you're giving some credence and some importance to the Kairos 2 document, etc., etc. But it's very interesting because if you look at what is happening in Gaza, it's a very simple example. 2 million people, a tiny, tiny, tiny, tiny Christian community. We keep talking about the Christian community. We forget the rest of the Gaza people.
Yes.
That is not our faith. If we look at the West Bank, if we look at what is happening, the bulldozing, the uprooting of olive trees, the attack on Palestinian farmers by illegal Israeli settlers, the Israeli army protecting the settlers rather than protecting the victims. And when the priest of Taibe or Aboud stands out, and he's a Christian, he stands out, he's an Orthodox Christian or a Catholic Christian, says, please help us. My question is, how do we help those people? And yet, we have to accept that there is in the West, and certainly in this country, which pretty much groomed this political reality into being in the early 1900s, we are afraid to speak. We always think three times before we need to speak, just in case we upset Israeli political sensitivities. Well, for me, there is a wide gap, a chasm between talking to a Jew and talking to an Israeli, talking to a politician and talking to an ordinary person. And we should have the courage, the prophetic courage, if you want, of saying it as it is, as we see it. Because otherwise, if it's 47, 38, in 10 years' time, 25, it's going to go unless something is done. And I think that the fact that Pope Francis, the late Pope Francis, used to call the parish priest in Gaza every day in the evening at 6 p.m. for a chat, kept Gaza and kept the Christian community in the limelight, which otherwise will not have been there. And so that, to me, is basically what is happening. There is a very interesting researcher by the name of Zaha Hassan who works with the Carnegie Endowment. And she said what is happening in Palestine, she was talking of Gaza and she was talking of the West Bank. She said what is happening in Palestine is not the rule of law, but the rule by law. We are using the law to vindicate our position rather than interpreting the law, international law as it is, and applying it. And for me, this was quite clear during the Doha Forum this week in Qatar. This has been clear to me throughout the Gaza war and even before that. And let me say here, so that people don't think I'm a riotous rebel, that this doesn't only happen in the West. Yes, it happens in the West. Okay, Spain speaks out, Ireland speaks out, Slovenia speaks out, Belgium speaks out, but there are 27 European countries and the EU is scared to speak out, but so are some Arab leaders. So the responsibility doesn't only fall on the Europeans, it also falls on the Arab leaders as well to be more truthful in their attitudes when it comes to the Palestinian situation. And that is what brings us full circle to the beginning of the conversation off mic, James, when you talked about hope. And hope is a word that kept creeping into our conversation now, in this hour or so that we've been talking about those two sides of the same coin. If you ask me, as Harry, as somebody who is unimportant, but whose faith is important for him, what is hope for you when you look at the larger MENA region and at Israel, Palestine in particular? I would tell you, for me, hope is merely staying alive. Hope is being able for a Palestinian farmer to preserve his property and to harvest it. Hope is being recognized as a child of God and not a subsidiary of God's grace and love that we celebrate during this period. That, to me, is what hope is.
That's very strong. I'm going to finish, starting with you, Bishop Jim, with a very, very simple question. I mean, we do see that this Christmas season, Christ, to a certain extent, is sort of hijacked and used for all manner of reasons. But I want to ask you a very simple question, and that is, what would your message be to Catholics, to Christians, to the wider world opening the doors? What would your message be about what we should be focusing on this Christmas time?
At a recent event for children, I said to them, you know, Jesus could have been born in a palace. He could have stayed in heaven. He could have been born anywhere. But he was born in a mess. He was born into our mess. Mess we make of our lives, the mess we make of our world, the mess we make in our families. But he's born into that mess so that there is always the hope of a possibility that things can be different and that we can be part of that difference. And if we ever lose sight of the hope that the world can be different and needs to be different, because that's the whole point of the incarnation, the redemption, the death and resurrection of Jesus, that he comes in order to unite heaven and earth, not for us to wait for heaven on earth, but to unite heaven and earth. A new creation has already begun, and the possibility of that new creation can never be exhausted. And that's the hope that sustains us. In our country, there's a bit of a nostalgia for a Christmas that perhaps we never experienced, a simpler, unadorned, less commercial Christmas. Well, that's the mess we live in. And we need to be able to find that hope and that possibility of a different world in our Christmas as it is, not necessarily as we wish it were.
That's beautifully put. And Harry, I'm going to surprise you again. And I'm going to invite you, if you want to use Hebrew, to use Arabic, use Armenian if you want, and leave us with a thought, please, at the end of this podcast, which has had two halves, political and spiritual. What would you like to leave our listeners with this Advent and Christmas?
The political and the spiritual cannot be totally divorced from each other. And therefore, in our spiritual lives, we should also be aware of the political realities, the political challenges, and have the courage to speak out when necessary. That, to me, is the hope that the birth of Jesus brings. It is a definition, my personal definition, of what salvation is. And when I talk about, for me, hope is merely staying alive, that in itself is an indictment of our humanity. Having said that, we also should rejoice because it is a miracle. The mystery of the incarnation is a miracle, just as the resurrection is a miracle. And if they didn't happen, we wouldn't be here. Yes, we would be here, but in different categories and understandings. And in that sense, I would say, and I want to say it only in Arabic, because not in Armenian, not in Hebrew, not in any of the other languages I speak, because the language of the people where the mystery took place nowadays is largely Arab. So, Eid Milad Majid Lakum Jamian. Inshallah Hal Eid Bid'u Lal Amal. والأمل هو هدية الحياة لكل شخص في هذه المنطقة. Basically, Merry Christmas to you all. This is the feast of hope. Hope that is a gift for everybody deprived of it today.
Well, that receives my thanks and appreciation. Very well said, and thank you very much. And also my thanks and appreciation to Bishop Jim Curry. Wonderful that you could be with us today. I think actually essential. And I think it really did make holistically make a beautifully rounded podcast where we were able to tackle the difficult things. And you yourself tackled some very challenging and difficult things, which, without projecting too far forward, might become part of our conversations when we visit the land.
Yes.
It certainly should, I think, how we look at that in context. So thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Harry Hagopian, as always, thank you so much for being with us. And I won't try and take on any Christmas message, because I think you've both done that rather well.
And James, if I might just end on a note to thank you as well for putting this Middle East analysis at the end of 2025 together. And I must say, holistically. Now that's a word to think about.
Well, let's leave everyone in hope, shall we? Listeners, thank you so much. We do, of course, wish you a very holy and peaceful Christmas in whatever you do over the season. Our thanks go to you as well for being with us through all this time. 17 years for myself and Harry, so it's a very, very long time, and we do appreciate you being with
us. It's a legacy.
It is, isn't it? So God bless you all, and thank you very much indeed.
God bless you.